This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The film director Sidney Lumet died of lymphoma last Saturday. He was 86. We're going to listen back to my interview with him. The New York Times obituary described Lumet as a director who preferred the streets of New York to the back lots of Hollywood, and whose stories of conscience, 12 Angry Men, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, The Verdict, Network, became modern American film classics. Lumet also made the 1964 film The Pawnbroker, starring Rod Steiger as a Holocaust survivor who owns a pawn shop, and Failsafe, about a nuclear showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Lumet directed Michael Jackson and Diana Ross in the 1978 musical The Wiz. He was given an honorary Academy Award in 2005. Let's start with a scene from Lumet's final film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which was released in 2007. It stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke as two brothers whose parents own a jewelry store. Hoffman plays a businessman and addict who's embezzled a large amount of money from his company. Facing an audit, he's in desperate need of cash. He's trying to rope his younger brother into helping him pull off a heist.
What are we doing?
To win.
It's a jewelry store. Does this ring a bell?
No.
What if I tell you it's got a footlocker on one side and a Claire's accessories on the other? Yeah, that's right. You got it. Now listen. We don't want Tiffany's. We want a mom-and-pop operation in a busy place on a Saturday with a week's take still in the safe. We both work there. We know the safe combinations. We know the burglar alarm signals. We know everything is. I figure between the week's take, the jewelry and the cases, the vault, there's a $500,000 haul. I figure probably six. That old dumb old lady that works there, she's alone till noon. She's not going to be a problem.
Andy.
Yeah?
That's Mom and Dad's store.
That's what I said. The mom and pop operation.
I spoke with director Sidney Lumet in 1988.
You've made about 38 movies in a little over 30 years. And it reminds me of the old studio days in a way, when there were a lot of movies being made and when directors and actors used to do a lot of movies per year. How have you managed to keep that pace up, especially considering how the movie industry has changed?
Lucky, Terry. No, I love work and I love movies. I think if I could ever, and these things are clearly impossible, but if I could have had the artistic freedom that I enjoy now under the old studio system, which would have been impossible, by the way, I think I would have been very happy working in a studio, because I love going from one project to another. I love when I work with actors who I find exciting to work with. I love repeating with them and working with them again and again.
So you think of yourself as having more artistic freedom now than you did when you were starting because of how the movie industry has changed?
Not partially.
Or because of your stature.
Part of it is muscle, you know. Yeah. You get a couple of hits behind you and you can slowly start encroaching into that area. But I think you're right. I think the studio system has changed. I don't think that Louis B. Mayer would have given me Final Cut no matter how many hits I'd had. He would have never given up that prerogative.
Now, you insist on that, right? When you take on a movie, you must have Final Cut, which means what exactly?
Well, it means that there can be nothing. The film cannot be touched after you finish editing it, whether in the soundtrack or visually. It's yours.
What kind of problem had you run into with previous movies that taught you needed to demand Final Cut?
Well, as an example, many, many years ago, I did a very, very interesting picture. I think a very good picture. It's one of the few that I like better now than at the time that I did it. A picture called The Hill with Sean Connery. And it was not much of a success in America, but a good picture. And at that time, I did it for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and at that time, they were being owned by a new person. They were changing hands almost daily. There were three new managements in the period of a year. And at one point, they just said it as a matter of company policy that a picture had to run 1 hour and 55 minutes because they thought that this would work well for their relationships with the exhibitors. And the picture ran 2 hours and 2 minutes, and they just insisted that I take 7 minutes out. They didn't care where it came from. It didn't matter to them that there were no 7 minutes to take out without destroying the movie. And it was a hell of a battle, and the only reason I won it, actually, was because management changed hands again, and a new management came in, which was listened with slightly more sympathetic ears. But if the old management had continued running Metro, they simply would have taken the film and removed 7 minutes, period.
Right.
And that kind of thing goes on constantly. A great many directors have suffered very severely from that.
And that's still going on.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your first film, made in 1957, and this was 12 Angry Men, a courtroom drama. You had before that been directing television, live television dramas. Was this a good transition to make since it was basically a one-set movie? It's a courtroom drama. It's a jury drama. They're in the deliberation room most of the movie. Was that a good place to start?
It was good, and it was a great problem, except that I was dumb enough not to know what the problem was. I found out after I had done the movie and people liked it that it was very difficult to shoot a movie in one room. That never occurred to me.
Really?
I had just plunged in with complete ignorance, knowing what I wanted to do with camera, knowing that I could make the camera a good interpretive part of the movie itself, and just blithely went ahead, shot it in 19 days, happy as a lark, and didn't know what the problem was. I may have felt enormously secure at the confinement of it because my background, as you say, had been live television and the theater. So the idea of staging something in one room was something that came very easily to me.
Well, the movie starred Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. Fonda is the only juror initially convinced of the defendant's innocent. Cobb is the last holdout. I want to play a clip from this movie, 12 Angry Men.
Did you ever see a woman who had to wear glasses and didn't want to because she thinks they spoil her looks?
Okay, she had marks on her nose. I'm giving you that. From glasses, right? She didn't want to wear them out of the house or people think she's gorgeous. But when she saw this kid killing his father, she was in the house alone. That's all.
Do you wear glasses when you go to bed?
No, I don't. No one wears eyeglasses to bed.
It's logical to assume that she wasn't wearing them when she was in bed, tossing and turning, trying to fall asleep.
How do you know?
I don't know. I'm guessing. I'm also guessing that she probably didn't put her glasses on when she turned to look casually out of the window. And she herself testified the killing took place just as she looked out. The lights went off a split second later. She couldn't have had time to put them on there.
Wait a second.
Here's another guess. Maybe she honestly thought she saw the boy kill his father. I say she only saw a blur.
How do you know what she saw? How does he know all that? How do you know what kind of glasses she wore? Maybe there were sunglasses. Maybe she was farsighted. What do you know about it?
I only know the woman's eyesight is in question now.
She had to be able to identify a person 60 feet away at night without glasses.
You can't send someone off to die on evidence like that.
Oh, don't give me that.
Don't you think the woman might have made a mistake?
No.
It's not possible.
No, it's not possible.
It's a heck of a cast. In addition to Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, you have Jack Warden, Jack Klugman, E.G. Marshall, Ed Begley. You directed them your first time out on film, and you've since directed Paul Newman and younger actors like Al Pacino and Treat Williams. Is there a difference in the acting styles of the actors who you were directing in the 50s and the actors who came of age in, say, the 70s?
Not really, Terry. The basic craft of acting is, in the United States, has been set for some years, really, even before the method came in. Basically, people like Fonda worked out of a profound sense of truth. In fact, a man like Fonda didn't know how to do anything falsely and used himself brilliantly. Both of those elements are foundations of the method, and even though he wasn't called a method actor in the sense of having studied the method, he basically worked out of that, as most good actors did.
Do you think of yourself as a method director?
No, I become the kind of director that becomes whatever his actors need. When I did Murder on the Orient Express, I could work the way the English actors work. When we did Long Day's Journey Into Night, there was a perfect example. Kate Hepburn has a very specific way of working, her own technique. Ralph Richardson is a prime example of British technique, which is primarily from what we call the outside in. Dean Stockwell works completely method from the inside out, and Jason has his own glorious world of creating something from inside himself, and heaven knows where it comes from. But I think part of the job of directing is to not make the actors work your way, but for you to work as a director any way that makes them comfortable.
You directed Al Pacino in two of his first big movie roles, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I want to play a short scene from Dog Day Afternoon, and maybe you could tell me what you think Al Pacino needed when he was getting started. This is a scene from the very opening of the movie when Pacino walks into a New York bank and he holds it up and he wants the money to buy a sex change operation for his lover.
Hey, freeze! Nobody move!
Get over there!
Okay. All right, get away from those alarms.
Cut!
Come on, get in the center. He moves. Take his head off. Put the gun on him. Get out of the center.
Sonny? I can't do it, Sonny.
What?
I'm not going to make it, Sonny.
What are you talking about? Put it on.
I can't do it, Sonny.
Sal. What? Where are you? He can't make it.
It's an interesting performance because Pacino is so manic in it and yet so insecure and incompetent at robbing this bank.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need when he was getting started? You were talking before about giving actors what you think they need.
Primarily what he needed was he needed a great sense of freedom and a great sense of restriction. The creation of the character is really Al's own. He understood something about that man that is irreplaceable, and I don't think a director can ever give. He understood him down to his bone marrow. What he needed was a sense of release, the confidence to know that as extreme as he got in the performance, that it would write, that it went... for example, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where he's talking to his female wife, his real wife, on the telephone, trying to decide what to do. And the scene is extraordinary in the sense that it requires a level of emotion that I've seen very rarely in movies. We did the scene in one take with two cameras because I didn't want him to have to repeat that emotion over and over again. And when he finished it the first time, it was wonderful. And without waiting an instant, I didn't even cut the cameras. I said, Al, go again. And he looked at me like I was crazy because he was exhausted. He was spent. And I said, right now, action. And what I was driving at was that he had reached such a height at the end of the first take, such an emotional peak. But that's really where I wanted the scene to begin.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the best pieces of movie acting I've ever seen. It was blinding in its intensity, agonizingly painful, and just reached a level of emotion that I don't think I've seen often in movie acting. And that knowledge that he could go as far as he wanted to within the confines of this situation and that man, the situation created by the script, the man created by Pacino, but that confidence to know that he could go as far as his feelings would carry him was very important to him, and that was really the biggest single directing relationship to his performance.
We're listening back to an interview with Sidney Lumet. He died Saturday at the age of 86. Here's the scene from Dog Day Afternoon that Lumet was just talking about. Al Pacino's character, Sonny, is doing his best to keep it together. The bank robbery is falling apart. He has a bank full of hostages, and he's dealing with the police and the hostage negotiator. In the midst of the chaos, he calls his wife.
I'm dying, you know that? I'm dying here.
Sonny, I blame myself. I notice you've been tense like something is happening. Like night before last, you're yelling at the kids like a madman. And then you want me to go on that ride, that caterpillar, from here to there full of those kids. It's ridiculous. I'm not about to go on the ride, so you yell at me. You pig, get on the ride. Well, everything fell out of me. My heart, my liver just fell to the floor. I mean, everything. You know what it felt like? You yelling at me like that in front of all them people? I mean, because he never talked to me like that before, Sonny. I think he's going to shoot me. He's going to dump my body in the river.
Will you just shut up?
I mean, I was scared of you. I was scared.
Will you shut the f*** and listen to me? Just listen to me!
You see that? See? With the language and everything.
Well, I'm trying to talk to you! And you...
A person can't communicate with you!
A scene from the 1975 film Dog Day Afternoon, directed by Sidney Lumet. Lumet typically shot only one or two takes of each scene.
I wonder if you ever run into conflicts where there's one actor in a scene who works really well on that first or second take, and another actor who sees it as their style to go for 15 or 16 takes until they really get it perfect. What do you do if you run into that?
I have run into it, and so far, if there were a piece of wood around the studio, I'd knock on it. But so far, I've been able to convince the 15 or 16 take actor that the other works. The early takes are not imperfect. They are usually the freshest, truest. The repetition I find, and I think for most good actors, the repetitions tend to become mechanical. One doesn't find more truth in it as it goes on. Now, that partially has to do with the way I work because, as you know, or may know, I rehearse very heavily. I rehearse 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the complexity of the characters, before we begin. And those rehearsals are conducted like theater rehearsals in the sense that people learn their lines completely, are working without scripts, they're completely blocked to the degree that we're having run-throughs by the end of it. So it's not as if once we get on camera that this is their first exposure.
Is that uncommon?
Yes, it is. It is. It is not done often. I think mostly those of us who were trained in television do it. I think Arthur Penn does it. I know Arthur Penn does it. John Frankenheimer and so on.
Oh, because you had to do it for the live drama.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And but it turned out for all of us, I think, in movies to have other advantages.
You know, between 12 Angry Men, The Verdict, Serpico, and Prince of the City, you've done your share of police and legal dramas. Is this a special interest of yours, or did you just like those scripts and want to do them?
It's funny, Terry. You know, I don't really analyze these things. Mm-hmm. I just respond instinctively to a piece of material. But obviously something in me somewhere is very involved with that level of life. Where it comes from, I don't know. But on looking back on it, boy, there are an awful lot of what I call justice stories. They somehow involve me very viscerally.
Have you been affected by the new craze of market research?
Yes, and fortunately, I've had my artistic controls in place before they ever came along because I think they are disastrous. I think they're destructive. I also think they're untrue. I think a person changes as soon as you ask them something.
So do you have a no market research clause when you take on...
No, because I can't prevent the studio from doing it, but mm-hmm. I sure in hell don't let it affect any of my decisions about what I'm going to do with the picture.
You obviously love film directing. When you're doing a movie, what's the part that you most look forward to and the part that you know you have to do but you really don't enjoy at all?
There's only one part that I have to do. All of it is a thrilling process to me, pre-production, shooting, post-production, editing, music. The only part that's a bit of a drag is what we call the mix, which is when we come in and do the final soundtrack and put every chair squeak in and every door slam in. It requires enormous concentration because it's largely a mechanical process rather than a creative one, although some directors use it very creatively. The soundtrack that I keep remembering particularly is the soundtrack of Apocalypse Now, which was a brilliant piece of work and a totally creative piece of work. However, you do have to do it. I feel I have to do it myself because if the mix is a bad mix, if the wrong thing is emphasized, it can seriously affect the movie and be very destructive to a movie. So I have to do it, but it's the only non-joyful part of movie making to me.
Let's hear a scene from Lumet's 1981 film, Prince of the City, adapted from a memoir by a New York City narcotics detective officer who exposed corruption in the unit. Jerry Orbach played one of the dirty narcotics detectives. In this scene, he storms into the office of one of the people in charge of the corruption investigation.
You indict me on a squawk of a dope dealer who tried to buy me out of a bust? You want to break up another federal operation that'll put away more quality mob guys in a year than you'll touch in your whole pissant career?
Detective Levy, you're hardly in a position...
I'll tell you what I'm in a position to do, and that's throw you out the window. It's only the fifth floor, but I'll try to aim you so you land on your pointed little head.
Levy, you can easily avoid trial. All you have to do is cooperate.
You got your mind made up to try me? Go ahead and try me. But not for a lousy $400. At least get me for assault.
Let's get back to our 1988 interview with director Sidney Lumet.
I want to play another short scene from another movie you directed, and this is Network, which came out in 1976. Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his performance in this. And in this scene, he plays a lunatic, self-styled, messianic broadcaster who is basically preaching his editorial.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And right after, as he's doing that editorial, people all over Manhattan in high-rise apartment buildings open up their windows, stick their heads out, and start yelling that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. I thought that scene really tapped into something, and for me what it tapped into is the fear is that in Manhattan, there's so many high-rises filled with so many people with all this pent-up anger. And if it was ever let loose, we'd really be in big trouble.
Well, Paddy Chayefsky had that unique ability to tap the most fundamental truths in people, in the individual characters, and also in terms of the situation that he was observing. Did you ever see a picture that he wrote called Hospital?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's hilarious as Network is with fundamentally a deeply serious idea behind it, and he did it in that too. I miss him every day.
Network was one of your many movies that was shot in New York locations. Now, I think you were really one of the first directors to actually do location shooting in Manhattan.
Yeah, Kazan first and me right behind him. But at that time, it wasn't fashionable at all. It was very difficult to put together more than one good movie crew because there was that little work going on here.
Why did you want to shoot on location in New York?
Well, once you were shooting in New York, there was almost no choice. We had very limited studio space in those days. So that you had no choice. But also it coincided clearly with the kind of picture we were doing, which were usually very realistic pictures, pictures that benefited visually from being done on location.
Were there problems when you were one of the pioneers doing that, since crews weren't used to it? The people on the streets weren't used to having movies shot outside their homes or their offices.
Yeah, but they were all good problems. The problems are much more severe now because everybody's so sophisticated. So they not only charge you a hell of a lot more to use their facility, but they're also a little bit more contemptuous and irritated by the inconvenience that shooting makes. In those days, it was glamorous. People were amazed by it, were diverted by it, enchanted by it. So that the problems in those days were actually less severe than the problems now.
Now, you really came from a theater family. Your father acted in the Yiddish theater. You acted when you were very young. I think you either performed in or a standby in the Dead End Kids on Broadway?
I wasn't one of the Dead End Kids. I was in the play. There were other children's parts.
It was a play called Dead End on
Broadway.
Okay. Right. Now, did this experience with the Yiddish theater via your father and your own performances help you understand actors as a director?
I think so, Terry. The biggest thing about actors is that they really are the infantry. They are the most exposed. And most good work, not just acting, but really any creative work, is a matter of use of self, self-exposure. And as I say, actors are the infantry in that. It's their emotions, their physiognomy that's being examined, rejected, accepted at the actual moment that they're doing it. They're right up there.
Why did you give up acting for directing?
I found that process very invading. When I got out of the Army, I'd been acting since I was 5 years old, and I got out of the Army in 25, and at 25, and went on with it for about another 3 years, and I was primarily a theater actor. I knew that good acting, as I say, is self-exposure to a large degree, and I got sort of embarrassed about revealing those parts of myself to 1,500 strangers a night, if you were in a hit, that is. Otherwise, it was to 50 strangers a night. But there was something about acting that no longer worked for me, and I just slowly drifted into directing.
Did having a father in the Yiddish theater help you love performance?
Absolutely,
drama?
Absolutely. The peculiar thing is there's a sort of strange post-World War II American problem. Children of actors and writers and directors tend to be nervous and upset. And more than nervous, they're terrified of going into their parents' work. And yet the history of the world is going into your parents' work. I mean, 2 years ago, I did a movie with Jane Fonda and Jeff Bridges, and I had worked with both of their fathers. I'd worked with Henry and I'd worked with Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very moving. I was thrilled at working with the two of them because that sense of continuity is lovely. It's the way it should be. And I'm quite sure that my father, being the actor he was and bringing me into the theater at a very early age, was an enormously beneficial and happy-making thing to happen to one.
My interview with film director Sidney Lumet was recorded in 1988. He died Saturday at the age of 86.